At liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nathan Schneider, who is an editor of the news analysis website Waging Nonviolence. He was the first reporter to cover the planning meetings that led to Occupy Wall Street and wrote about it for Harper's Magazine, The Nation, and The New York Times, as well as in his new book, Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nathan Schneider.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
And you say that the Occupy movement has been both surprisingly successful and a disappointing failure. So explain, if you will.
Well, I think it was successful in that it captured the imagination of the country and people all around the world. And it was a failure, I think, mostly in to the extent that it didn't manage to live up to the expectations that it placed in people's imaginations. It put an ambition for revolutionary change in a lot of people's minds, and still hasn't manifested the capacity to make that happen.
Well, is that the disconnect between people who wish things would happen and people who actually get off their butts and take to the streets and make it happen?
Well, I think it's a disconnect about how you get off your butt and take to the streets. I mean, there's a role for protest politics and for performance and for, attention getting and media savvy performances. That's a lot of what Occupy Wall Street was so good at. It was full of artists and people who are skilled in the work of capturing people's imagination. But it still wasn't able to develop the kinds of political structures, the kinds of broad networks and federations of people that would live up to its ambitions that it would require to push for change.
But it does seem, though, that the framing, and the neuroscientist out here at Berkeley, George Lakoff, has often talked about the deficit of framing on the political left in this country, that the right wing are much cleverer at framing arguments, like the choice between pro-life and pro-choice. That's an example. So it seems to me that this time around, the enduring legacy in many ways is the framing of the 99% versus the 1%.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot more than framing going on. I mean, as far as hearts and minds, Occupy Wall Street was almost a winner from the beginning. Within a couple of weeks of its start, more than half of the country was approved of what was going on and supported it, according to polls. So I think the framing, as you said, was very strong. I think the difference was the capacity to build political structures that would back up that framing, and that's something that the right has done very well. You know, I have also spent a lot of time reporting in right-leaning mega churches in this country, and there you see actually a lot of the things that the anarchists and Occupy call for. Mutual aid, people supporting one another to get their basic needs met, the kind of things that just make community life better. And that's a very powerful basis for political organizing, and that is the kind of thing that makes a frame really have teeth.
So do you think, though, Nathan Schneider, that, and you refer to Bill de Blasio's primary victory in New York in your recent writing as perhaps being a harbinger of a change, given that he's an unapologetic progressive, and obviously he is the opposite to the incumbent or the outgoing mayor, Bloomberg, who is very much, a Wall Streeter. So are we at the beginning of something here? Some people are starting to think that there may be a kind of progressive backlash emerging out of this decade that's brought us the Iraq War, the Afghan War, the Wall Street crash. I mean, nothing but, I think, flagrant examples of capitalism out of control, foreign policy out of control, greed out of control, and incompetence being rewarded.
Well, I think yes and no, as far as there being a major change having happened. you know, in some ways, I think that the election of de Blasio in New York is a continuation of President Obama's re-election in 2012. You know, he painted Mitt Romney as the candidate of the 1%, using kind of the resources of Occupy rhetoric, drawing upon the way in which Occupy had changed the conversation in order to turn people against Mitt Romney. De Blasio made a kind of similar turn in the course of the New York election. You know, a few months ago, he didn't really stand out as the most progressive candidate, but then he really started pushing kind of Occupy language, talking about income inequality, talking about racism and racial inequality, especially in discriminatory policing in New York. Those are issues that Occupy Wall Street really fought to get on the radar. And you know, he used that rhetoric to carry him to victory. On the other hand, you know, both Obama and de Blasio, I think, in high office, have yet to really show that they are willing to make the real political changes to live up to that rhetoric, to regulate the banks, to you know, to bring about policies and approaches to doing politics that are more ground up rather than, you know, continually serving the interests of the you know, of the richest industries and individuals.
Again, I'm speaking with Nathan Schneider, who's the editor of the news analysis website Waging Nonviolence. He was the first reporter to cover the planning meetings that led to Occupy Wall Street and wrote about it for Harper's Magazine, The Nation, and The New York Times, as well as in his new book, Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. Well, of course, de Blasio, he's got to do a runoff. I mean, he's just finished a runoff, and he's got to run against the Republican. And then if he becomes mayor, which I guess is likely, then we can start judging him. And in terms of Obama framing Romney, don't you think that Romney's own words helped frame him a lot with his private meeting that one of the waiters videotaped where he talked about the 47% of freeloaders in this country?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And Obama kind of echoed that in the debates and so forth. And that was kind of when Obama started to be viewed as a stronger candidate for re-election. When before, in the earlier debates, he was more talking about kind of old-fashioned politics. As soon as he embraced the populist rhetoric, he started going off to victory and was able to play off Romney's mistakes.
But there are many things about the millennial generation, and I covered the Occupy movement here in Los Angeles and spent a lot of time down at City Hall where the Occupy movement had camped on the grounds of City Hall. And what resonated and echoed quite a bit was issues related to student debt and to this irony that we have created a society with the most sophisticated young consumers known to man who are incredibly social media savvy, but yet they don't have the purchasing power to participate in the American dream that's been promised to them. And it's worse than that because many of them have been indentured and laden with debt before they even get a job. So is it possible that we are going to see, as the millennials get more and more political, a political shift in this country, more in the direction that Occupy movement heralded?
Yeah, well, I think there were ways in which the movement pointed to some kind of idiosyncrasies of this generation. You know, this is a moment where, you know, it's after the Cold War, and a lot of the older political left organizations, you know, socialist organizations, for instance, had really fallen apart and don't have the same kind of influence that they once had. And so in a lot of cases, these young people haven't really had a political language to articulate and to understand the situation in which they find themselves. And they're very individualized. They don't even see, for instance, their mounting debt as a political issue. They see it as a personal issue, and they associate it with a lot of shame and guilt, and they don't want to talk about it. And one of the things that was really so important about Occupy was it started to create a language for this generation. It kind of started from scratch using using anarchist models of organizing and of describing what was going on. It enabled people to start to rethink of themselves as political subjects, as people with a political problem, not just a personal problem. You know, the question is that when you're starting from scratch like that, you know, you don't have the history of organizations the infrastructure of organizations that you need to really be effective. And so the challenge right now, you know, is for all these people who've been awakened and who've come to realize that they are facing a political crisis, to build the political institutions that will enable them to force that crisis onto the people in power.
Well, but, you know, this is a generation that grew up after Reagan. And, you know, the politics in this country on the right have been defined by Reagan, and on the left in the Democratic Party by Clinton. And those have been the two choices. And it seems to me that some of the polling that's been done by Pew Research on the millennials indicate that there's something of a generational shift underway where they're not too thrilled with capitalism itself. I mean, it's the first polling that indicated a majority of young people are not necessarily in favor of capitalism. They're more in favor of socialism. So is it possible something's stirring there in this arid and barren political environment we have, where you have the Reagan cheer squad on one side and the Wall Street Clintonistas and, you know, pro-business Democrats on the other?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a real anti-capitalist awakening going on, but there's a lot of nervousness about the words. You know, I think a lot of people who you talk to in Occupy and people associated with it, you know, if you kind of quiz them about where they stand about particular issues, yeah, they don't see capitalism as the solution. They don't see markets fixing things. They see markets screwing things up. You know, on the other hand, there's still a lot of nervousness about words like socialism, anarchism, anti-capitalism. You know, they want to talk about something different. And there's a bit of a danger there. You know, I think part of the appeal of some of the anarchist organizing that was so exciting for people in Occupy, that seemed to flatten, level the playing field and make something new possible, is that it's being used on the internet and through the tech sector, you know, as a kind of trick. You know, people feel like they're organizing, quote-unquote, horizontally if they're doing it on Facebook and Twitter, you know, but they're doing it through powerful corporate industries and corporate interests. And, you know, and the people who work in these tech companies might feel that they're working in this very kind of, like, horizontal, very, very egalitarian work environment, yet it's still very much being driven by the capitalist system. So there's a way in which capitalism has adapted to this longing for something a bit more egalitarian, and given people the perception that they're participating in it, when in fact they're not. And meanwhile, all of the stuff we're posting to social media is being sent straight to the NSA.
Well, you know, that's having apparently a detrimental effect on U.S. business. A lot of foreign businesses are saying they're not too happy about doing business with the United States anymore because they don't want their privacy invaded. One of the ironies of the NSA thing is that it's actually having a capitalist backlash.
Yeah, and, you know, that kind of thing will happen. But I think the point is you know, and that thing that's really important about what's happening now is that it's having a political backlash. It's awakening people to a sense that something very wrong is going on, and the question is whether people are going to sit by and take it and forget about it and you know, feel like there's nothing that can be done, or whether they will start to organize and start to build the power to resist. It's totally possible. You know, people all around the world throughout history have organized and resisted some of the worst regimes and the you know, the worst power structures, and won. You know, I think the United States, unfortunately, has tended to forget a lot of that history, and people feel isolated and feel powerless.
Well, it does seem that there is, as I say, there seems to be some stirrings. And curiously enough, on the right, it looks as though the more radical voices are going to become prominent during the election year, and particularly this coming election year, and particularly in 2016 with Rand Paul running away with a lot of support. Now, a lot of young people are somewhat beguiled by libertarianism, and they find it attractive. First of all, Rand Paul's the only guy that stood up on the Senate and actually filibustered against the NDAA. Progressive senators didn't do that. So that attracts a lot of people, the fact that he's against these wars, et cetera, that young people are absolutely fed up with and disgusted by. But he doesn't advertise the fact that he wants to turn over America to corporations and get rid of government itself. So what's your sense then in terms of who's going to reap the harvest of this discontent that came to the fore with the Occupy movement? Will a new progressive movement reap it, or will a new libertarian movement on the right reap it?
Well, it's hard to say, and I think it's still up in the air. You know, one thing you see from all of these revolutions and uprisings of 2011 is that, you know, in a lot of cases, it isn't the group that actually sparks the uprising that reaps the benefits of it. You know, in Egypt, for instance, you see, you know, it's a largely kind of secular, educated youth, young adult movement that gave birth to the uprising at Tahrir Square. But it was the Muslim Brotherhood and the military, the two most organized, thickly organized segments of Egyptian society that took over. And, you know, if you think about that kind of thing in the United States, you know, right now, it's kind of similar. It's religious organizations and the military that are probably the most well-organized segments of our society, and that if things really broke down, we would probably step in. That's why I think it's so important to think in terms of what kinds of organizations are going to spark up. And you know, even if you're looking at anarchism, which was probably the class of ideology that was most attractive to people in Occupy Wall Street, you know, if you look at the First International in the 19th century, or you look at the Spanish Revolution in the 20th century, there have been times in history where large federated organizations on anarchist principles have been able to exist and function. You know, these are models that could be used for building out the movement today.
Well, Nathan Schneider, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
I do too. Again, I've been speaking with Nathan Schneider, who's the editor of the news analysis website Waging Nonviolence. He was the first reporter to cover the planning meetings that led to Occupy Wall Street and wrote about it for Harper's Magazine, The Nation, and The New York Times, as well as in his new book, Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One time, one night.